Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hi, this is Here and Now Anytime, where we give you a little news, a little something you weren't expecting, and always a fresh, in-depth perspective on current events, arts and culture, and stories that matter. Subscribe or follow to get all our episodes out every weekday. And if you like what you hear, tell a friend about us to help spread the word. Now here's the show.
Every person should have a right and the ability to have access to clean water. And it should not matter where you live or how much money you earn or how much money you got in your back pocket.
Well, it does matter how much money the government's got in its back pocket. And today, it's pulling out a few billion dollars for water infrastructure. It's Wednesday, February 21st, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Later on the show, we've got two stories of how abortion restrictions are rippling across society. We'll consider the Alabama Supreme Court ruling that cites the Bible in contending frozen embryos should be considered extrauterine children. And we'll hear the story of one family in Tennessee that struggled to scrape by after they were denied an abortion for a life-threatening pregnancy.
Republican lawmakers who call themselves pro-life have been banning abortion and celebrating the expectation that this will mean more children, but what have they done to ensure that those children have the best possible future once they're here?
But first, how's your drinking water? With all the headlines in recent years about lead pipes, boil water advisories, and the like, you might be forgiven for casting a skeptical eye at the tap. Well, today, America's ailing water infrastructure is getting a boost. That was Vice President Kamala Harris we heard at the top of the show, touting nearly $6 billion in federal funds to states, territories, and tribes for projects promoting clean drinking water and reliable sewer systems. So what good will it do? We asked Darren Olson of the American Society of Civil Engineers. He spoke to Peter O'Dowd.
Well, it certainly is great news. The federal government has been underinvesting in our water infrastructure for decades. Back in the 1970s, 63% of the water infrastructure capital funding came from the federal government. And in 2017, that was down to 9%. So their funding has gone down, but with the IIJA, the infrastructure bill, that has now reversed course.
Yeah. Well, your group's most recent assessment from 2021 gave the country's drinking water infrastructure a grade of C-. You pointed out that there's a water main break in the U.S. every 2 minutes. 6 billion gallons of treated wastewater are lost each day. As you look around the country, where's the greatest need?
Really, the greatest need starts in the oldest communities. Those are the ones where, like here in Chicago, even recently, they were pulling water transmission pipes out of the ground that were made of wood. And so this infrastructure has been in some of these communities for centuries and is in need of upgrade.
Wow. Wood, it was still in use?
That is correct. Yep.
And is that safe?
No, that's... So that is, obviously part of the city's program to upgrade Chicago's water distribution system, and they were encountering old pipes like that, and they were being removed.
Wow. Although I have never heard of wood pipes in a modern city, the issue in general is no secret. In 2014, people were getting lead poisoned from corroded water pipes in Flint, Michigan. Just recently, 2022, in Jackson, Mississippi, heavy rains overwhelmed the city's main water treatment plant, and that cut off access to drinking water for 150,000 people. What kind of investment would it take to solve these problems for good?
So we've estimated in a report that we did in 2021 that the gap, which is the difference between the funding that's available and the need, the gap, the 10-year gap was $434 billion for our water infrastructure. So when you think about the investment, and certainly the IIJA was a great investment in our water infrastructure, it's really just a down payment on that.
Wow. Where will the rest of the money come from?
The hope is that this begins a process of reinvigorated federal investment in our water infrastructure, and we can now begin to turn the tide towards going from where we are now, which is underinvesting, shifting towards strong leadership and strong investment in our water infrastructure.
You know, I mentioned Flint. After that crisis, there was a lot of efforts to replace lead pipes all over the country. How much progress have we made on that front?
So that the lead service line issue is one that is really at the forefront of our water infrastructure needs. There are 9.2 million lead service lines in the United States where water is coming from the main in your street into a home through a lead service line. Here in Chicago, we have 400,000 of them. And so when you think about replacing all of those, that is a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done. That's going to need not just investment today or tomorrow. That's going to take investment over decades to accomplish all of those.
I know you're working on next year's water infrastructure report card as we speak. Do you have any highlights or observations that you can share with us?
Well, I think we certainly have a lot of challenges. One of the things we haven't talked about is climate change and how that affects our water infrastructure. Yes, that's certainly, as we have hotter summers, that affects the ability for our reservoirs to maintain water for water supply. That leads to greater rain events that then makes it difficult for our wastewater systems and our stormwater systems to keep up. So while we've seen in some additional funding, which is fantastic as a down payment, we're also seeing additional challenges. We've got kind of those two competing interests.
Darren Olson is with the American Society of Civil Engineers, talking to us about this investment that the Biden administration is making into the country's drinking water and wastewater systems. Darren, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up next, people struggling with fertility issues in Alabama have had their medical treatment cut short by conservative judges who say frozen embryos should be considered children. After the break, Scott Tong speaks with a bioethicist about what the ruling could mean for patients across the country. Stick around.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance. You call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. Tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options within your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive, and it's Name Your Price tool. Say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show coverage options within your budget. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
These days, news comes at you fast. But the truth? Getting there takes time.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Embedded is a podcast that takes the time to look beyond the headlines.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
With original documentary storytelling. Listen to NPR's Embedded wherever you get your podcasts.
Every year in this country, hundreds of thousands of patients use embryos for in vitro fertilization. Now the Alabama Supreme Court has ruled that frozen embryos are people. And today, the University of Alabama at Birmingham Health System paused IVF treatments, citing legal liability. Let's bring in Glenn Cohen. He studies medical ethics and is a law professor at Harvard. Glenn, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
So just to start, remind us what an embryo is and medically how it differs from a fetus.
Yeah, so an embryo is essentially a fertilized egg, and it's what we refer to at the early stages of development, typically before implantation into a woman's body, whereas a fetus is one that has been implanted and is being carried by a woman.
Yeah, okay, so let's talk about this Alabama case. It has to do with a fertility clinic in Mobile, Alabama. It stores frozen embryos meant to be implanted into women at a later date. One patient got into the facility, dropped a container with embryos, destroying them, and three couples who supplied these embryos sued, saying it was wrongful death. What was the key to the ruling by the state Supreme Court?
Yeah, so the question is, Alabama has a statute called the Wrongful Death of a Minor Act, and the question is, what does the phrase minor child in that statute mean? And the court's majority, Justice Mitchell wrote the opinion, essentially said there is no exception, as he put it, for quote-unquote extrauterine children. And essentially the idea is that the phrase minor child in the statute also includes, in his view, an unborn or recently born individual from fertilization until the age of majority.
Yeah. And so what strikes you when you think about the significance of this ruling or the language used in it?
Yeah, so let me start with the language used in it. And again, it was multiple concurring opinions by different justices, but in particular in Chief Justice Parker's concurrence, there's language that I think would strike many people as somewhat theocratic, if you will. He says, for example, that the basis for his view is that the sanctity of life adopted by the people of Alabama encompasses that God made every person in his image. Each person has a value that exceeds the ability of human beings to calculate, and human life cannot be wrongfully destroyed without incurring the wrath of a holy God. So that's the kind of language that you like, you know, wake up and you say, didn't expect to see that in a judicial opinion. But throughout the opinion, there is this attempt to normalize the idea of the personhood of embryos and the idea that essentially they are, as one of the justices put it, extrauterine children. That is really out of step with, I think, about how most Americans think about embryos. But it's part of a longer-term attempt by the conservative legal movement to bring this idea of embryonic and fetal personhood into the mainstream.
So this raises a lot of legal questions I want to put to you then. So in Alabama now, does it mean it's okay to freeze embryos? Is it okay to destroy embryos that are unused? What does it mean for doctors who provide these services as far as their legal risk now?
So the opinion itself is really a construction of this wrongful death statute, which is a tort statute. But I think, you know, we can read between the lines and the implications are pretty serious. And indeed, the dissenting opinion by Justice Cook makes the point that the main opinion's holding will mean that the creation of frozen embryos will end in Alabama, he writes. No rational medical provider would continue to provide services for creating and maintaining frozen embryos, knowing that they must continue to maintain those embryos forever or risk the penalty of a wrongful death act claim for punitive damages. And essentially, the great irony of this case is that the people who brought this claim are people who had embryos, who cared a lot about the ability to use those embryos and lost them because they were destroyed. But the end result of this case is likely that there will be no freezing of embryos in Alabama, and that might cause many of the IVF clinics to stop doing business in Alabama altogether.
So what about the implications then outside of Alabama after the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, overturned Roe v. Wade? You co-authored a piece about the potential for this kind of question surrounding embryos. In your view, does this ruling create momentum for future rulings, future state laws that mirror this one?
So, you know, the court itself is kind of recognizes in various points that this is an unusual ruling, that it departs from that of sister states. But it's certainly kind of grist for the mill for people who want to bring this idea of fetal and embryonic person to the fore in legal infrastructure. And the idea here is that the end game of some members of the conservative legal movement is to have a federal ban on abortion altogether. And one way to get there would be to have a ruling that fetuses and indeed embryos are persons within the 14th Amendment. So they're protected by the federal constitution, such that it becomes unconstitutional to allow abortion to exist anywhere in the United States. We're a long way off from that, but decisions like this are a step in that direction. I'll just make one more point, which is to say,
yes,
we've had many ballot initiatives, like in Mississippi in 2011, to get this idea of personhood before the voters, and they've routinely failed. And now we're seeing those same ideas filter through not by the voters, but by the judges.
Yeah, through the courts. Glenn Cohn is professor at Harvard Law School, and he studies medical ethics. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Well, as we follow what happens with that case, we've got another story now of how restrictions on reproductive medicine are putting people in difficult, even impossible positions. When we return, the story of a denied abortion, the painful year that followed, and the fraying of America's social safety net. That's after the break.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor Lisa in collaboration with West Elm. Discover the new natural hybrid mattress, expertly crafted from natural latex and certified safe foams, designed with your health and the planet in mind. Visit leesa.com to learn more.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell and show up exactly the way you want to. Customize your online store to your style. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR.
The Indicator from Planet Money is all in on video games. Not just because they're a fun hobby. Video games are one of the fastest growing businesses worldwide, worth more than the film and music industries combined.
We're seeing some games that are really taking, $500 million to make.
We're taking a week-long look at the video game industry. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we have very important people on our show and then ask them about very unimportant things. Here's U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen.
We are also reliably informed that among your enthusiasms, in addition to macroeconomic policy, is mobile games.
There is some truth in that.
There's some truth in that.
Join us for the NPR podcast that considers all the other things. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Mayrin Hollis nearly died giving birth, but that was only the beginning. She'd gotten pregnant in 2022, just after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, and the state she lived in, Tennessee, had instituted one of the nation's strictest bans on abortion. The embryo had implanted in scar tissue from a previous C-section, and doctors warned Hollis that she and her fetus might not survive. But she couldn't travel out of state, for reasons we'll hear in a minute. As photographer Stacey Kranitz and reporter Kavita Surana tell it for ProPublica, what happened next is a story of pain and resilience, and an intimate portrait of a year in the life of a family struggling to get by after an abortion denied. They spoke to Scott Tong.
Kavita, can I ask you to set the scene? Leading up to this pregnancy, Mayrin Hollis and her husband Chris had battled addiction, they were in recovery, they had financial stress, as well as a legal fight with the state for custody of Mayrin's other children, and then comes this pregnancy. How risky was this pregnancy for the fetus, for the mother?
Yeah, doctors tell me that they knew it would be unlikely for the fetus to make it to term, and that it's so rare that people continue these pregnancies because they are so dangerous that there's little data on the chances for survival for either of them. So they knew that if Mayrin continued the pregnancy, the baby would definitely come early and may not survive.
Mm. Tell us about the choice they had before them, whether to leave the state, whether that was logistically or even financially possible.
Doctors referred Mayrin to a hospital in Pennsylvania, but that didn't feel like a real option for her family because that trip would take at least 4 days, partly because Pennsylvania has laws that require patients to wait between the consultation and the actual procedure. Mm. But Mayrin and her husband, had been in recovery for a few years. Their jobs were really important to them. And they didn't want to lose them. And in addition, Mayrin had an open child welfare case that she was doing her best to be available for whatever the authorities needed so she could get custody of her daughter back. So she just didn't feel that traveling was a real option for her. Mm. And a lot of families are in positions like that.
So she carries the pregnancy, and her baby daughter, Elena, was born 3 months early at the end of 2022. She weighed less than 2 pounds. Stacey, what was it like just observing that awful, precarious moment?
Well, we met Mayrin right after she had given birth for the first time. And it was, remarkable to see that she was lucid, functional. She didn't have a lot of options for seeing the baby because the baby was in such fragile shape. But she had this window from her hospital room that was the window for the NICU, and she would just look out and sort of think about her baby.
Yeah, and as the story goes, just days after Mayrin was discharged from the hospital, she was arrested. And my goodness, I mean, this is like the Old Testament story of Job. Kavitha, what was she arrested for, and what did this next chapter bring?
She was arrested on a felony charge. She had a child welfare case opened on her earlier in the year over accusations that she left her daughter in the car while she was inside a shop, and prosecutors took up the case and arrested her over it.
And this arrest, as you write it, depletes the family savings. They don't have a lot to start out with. Neither parent has paid parental leave. So the two parents, Mayrin and Chris, they go back to work even as she is recovering from surgery. How do they piece together the money to provide for the family, to provide for baby Elena?
Yeah, I mean, we spent a year documenting this family's life just to look also at what kind of resources were available to them in Tennessee, which has some of the lowest rankings in the nation for maternal health, infant mortality, and child poverty measures. And we were really curious to examine, you know, since Roe fell, Republican lawmakers who call themselves pro-life have been banning abortion and celebrating the expectation that this will mean more children. But what have they done to ensure that those children who are often born into difficult circumstances have the best possible future once they're here? What does that safety net look like? And here what we found was, you know, two parents who were working very hard at physically demanding jobs, and everywhere they turned, finding so many challenges to access resources that could help them support this baby.
Yeah, the father installs siding, a very difficult physical job, and Mayrin, the mother, her job is installing
an
insulation.
Insulator. I mean,
just very physically tiring, demanding jobs, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, we were watching them. So Mayrin was leaving at between 3:30 and 4 a.m. each morning when she was finally able to go back to work. And then Chris would really get the girls up, get them ready, and then he would leave at 7 a.m. And then there was a babysitter who stayed with him all day. When Mayrin got home at, like, you know, 3 or 4 p.m., you know, she's obviously exhausted, but then she has to set out to clean the house, prepare dinner, bathe the kids. It was very intense to watch her. It was really just remarkable resilience.
Yeah. I mean, this is a picture of a family, a picture of resilience, also a picture of the American safety net, as you tell and show the story. And as far as the food stamp program, their monthly income, which is not high, put them just above the eligibility limit, $39,000 a year for a family of four. So they're disqualified from those benefits. And Stacey, you know, I just, as you're watching this, is part of you thinking, you know, this is part of an America that a lot of us might not see?
Yeah, I think so. You know, they lost their food stamps a couple days before Thanksgiving. Between Thanksgiving and Christmas was one of the most difficult times for the family. But what was so remarkable to me was to witness the repeated bias against Mayrin in the hospital, at the bank, at the car dealership, in the courtroom, just constant reminders of her past while she was attempting to carve out a new future. And I think that that was one of the most difficult things for them, is that they just weren't given any breaks.
Hmm. And when you say bias, this is interesting to me, is that these are people in town who know of her past, who know of her addiction past, and this just stays with her?
Yeah, in the hospital, they do know her past. You know, in the courtroom, they know her past as well. But in places like the car dealership, they didn't, but they treated her differently because they knew that she had not enough of a credit history.
Yeah. Kavitha, in the end, you know, so much of the story has this baby Elena at the center. How's she doing today, as far as you know?
Well, she's definitely come a long way. She's starting to learn to walk. She's hit a lot of milestones. And, you know, doctors say that babies born that early, there's still a lot of challenges over their first couple years of their life. But she's a happy baby, and her family loves her.
Yeah.
When I was there last week, one of the main things I noticed is that not only is she starting to walk, but she's starting to become a lot more verbal and starting to, you know, say words. And it is really wonderful, especially because I know Maren's still concerned about the developmental deficiencies that she might encounter.
Yeah, I mean, just being born so, so tiny. Kavitha, if I can kind of ask you for the final word, when you kind of step back and think about what you've learned, what comes to mind?
I think just so many things to learn from this story. And I think one of the powerful things about it is that thanks to Stacy's photography, that it really immerses you in their lives. And you can see for yourself how they navigated things. And we would often sit with her while she made phone calls or go with her while she spoke to different social workers at the hospital. It was such a testament to how difficult it can be to access safety net resources in the state. I think anyone can relate, but especially for families that are working poor, living on the edge, you know, she would try to devote a day to trying to track down things and get hung up on or not have the right form or get promised something, but no one followed up. And it is crushing to watch. And I think the family was extremely brave and vulnerable to let us in to document their lives in such an intimate time.
Yeah. Kavitha Sarana is a reporter at ProPublica. We've also spoken to Stacy Kranitz, ProPublica photographer, and we will link you to the story they both worked on. The story is The Year After a Denied Abortion on our website, hereandnow.org. Stacy, Kavitha, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Scott. Thanks for having us.
That's our show. It comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Gabrielle Healy, Ashley Locke, and me, Chris Bentley. Today's editors were Todd Munt, Micaela Rodriguez, Julia Corcoran, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Caleb Green. Mike also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Integrative Therapeutics, with vitamins and supplements previously available only through practitioners, including Cortisol Manager. Unlock your best self with clinician-curated supplements from Integrative Therapeutics, now on Amazon. Support for this podcast and the following message come from the United States Postal Service. Turn shipping to your advantage with USPS Ground Advantage service. Learn how to gain a competitive edge at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.